Good morning, Schenectady UUs. It's a joy to be with you today, and it's a special blessing for me to have time with my beloved colleagues in ministry and my dear, dear friends, Wendy and Lynn. Thank you so much for welcoming me here today. Today is a celebration. And while we are grateful that long ago St. Patrick drove the snakes out of Ireland, what we are most celebrating is the power and importance of this congregation as a place that makes love real. Love changes everything. That's my topic for this morning. And to begin, let me give you a metaphor. Imagine that love is like music sounding in the depths of our hearts. It's a music of joy, voices in the coffee shop, a clattering ragtime, or hands clapping in unison at a rally to a chant calling for justice. It's a music of compassion. The cello, a cinnamon sound, soft and low through the broken windows of Sarajevo. Or the bagpipe, plaintively keening as a community gathers to mourn its dead. And it's a music of assurance, a parent singing, "Sleep, my child, may peace attend thee all through the night." Or a congregation, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." This music that sounds in the depths of our hearts tells us we are loved and calls us to be loving. But this music can be lost. The poet Adrienne Rich says, "Losing track of the music of love is like being a child torn from your mother." In one of her poems, she writes, "At most, we're allowed a few months of simply listening to the simple line of a woman's voice singing a child against her heart. Everything else is too soon, too sudden, the wrenching apart. That woman's heartbeat heard ever after from a distance." And James Baldwin speaks of how racism stops the music. Racism, he says, makes one's soul like a drum beat to which no answering drum ever sounds. Too often, the music of love is drowned out by violent cacophonies. Children locked in cages at the border. Police killings of unarmed African Americans. Hate crimes against immigrants. Shots ringing out in the mosque. Bodies falling. Earth's water polluted, the sea creatures choking on plastic. So many painful realities suggest that the human community is not moving to the rhythm of love, and it's fierce imperative that we do right by one another and the earth. And it happens in our individual lives, too. Many of us are not strangers to the experience of losing track of love's music. Events estrange us from feeling, trusting, or giving love. Perhaps we were harshly mistreated as children, bullied, abused, or neglected. Or life tears what we most cherish away from us, a spouse or beloved friend dies too soon. Perhaps it is always too soon. Or a marriage comes to an end and we are heartbroken, or the job we always wanted goes to someone else, or we lose a job that gave us meaning and sustained our family. Or we are sent into combat and participate in actions or see things that unmoor us from any sense of morality or human decency. However it happens in any one of our lives, yours or mine, life's harsh realities can drown out the music of love, and we can find ourselves adrift. We move through our days in a cloud of numbness, aware that we aren't fully feeling or thinking, or we become passive. We live with the sense that we are powerless in the face of overwhelming systems of injustice, or that life has become meaningless. When love is lost to us, we need experiences of embodied grace that wake the music up again in the depths of our hearts, reconnect us to our power to love, and remind us that we are loved. Such reawakening is possible. Even those who are physically deaf can feel the vibration and rhythm of music. I have seen the deaf dance. And whether we feel it or not, the music is always sounding, and we can find it again. This is what religious community often does for us. I know this from my own life. When I have lost my way, it is church that again and again has brought me back to love, showed me that love is possible. So let me tell you some stories. I started in the ministry right out of seminary. I was 24 years old. I didn't know anything. And I was sent to serve a little church in Seattle, a United Methodist congregation that was about to close. It was struggling. And it was a time when anti-gay sentiment was heating up in our city. And the church had a few closeted gay members. Now, you need to know that people mostly did not come out in those days. Queer and transgender and non-binary people were rarely safe. But our two gay members wanted their church to help, and they decided to come out at a church board meeting. With trembling voices, they told the leaders of the church the truth about who they were, their struggles, their hopes, how much they loved the church, and that they wanted to be known in truth. And then they asked the church to pass a motion to make a public and proactive statement in support of lesbian and gay people. There was stunned silence around the table. Then Cecil, the president of the congregation, stood up. No one ever stood up at church board meetings. Cecil was an imposing white guy, a merchant marine with tattoos to prove it. He'd grown up poor in Oklahoma, had an eighth grade education, and was a four square gospel Christian. Cecil put his fist down on the table and said, The Bible is perfectly clear. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. And as far as I know, he put no restrictions on who our neighbor is. So let's do this. If we do, we will lose our relationships with some members of this congregation who read their Bible differently. But if we don't, we will lose our relationship with God. Then he sat down. The board discussed for an hour and voted yes. So we set about creating a way to express hospitality and welcome and to advocate for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks. But we quickly discovered that queer folk who had been kicked out of churches weren't going to come to church just because we hung out a welcome sign. There was no basis of trust for a trust that we meant what we said. How did people know we weren't trying to lure them in to our church so we could convict them of their sin, which happened to many people? So no one just came to church. They called first. Testing the waters, they'd ask, is this the church that says lesbians and gays are welcome? And at first, we didn't always know if the caller was a person looking for a church that would genuinely welcome them, or if it was a person who felt our stand was wrong and wanted to make sure we knew exactly where hell was and how close we were to falling in. We got a lot of calls like that. And Nina, our church administrator, became highly adept at handling the calls. She would carefully explain our church's stand, that we welcomed people as they were. We accepted people of diverse sexual orientations. Nina told me that every caller would eventually come around to saying, well, the real reason I'm calling is. And one day the caller said, the real reason I am calling is I am a man, but I prefer to dress as a woman. That's who I really am. What I want to know is if I come to church in a dress, will I be welcome? Nina pondered for a second and said, is it a really ugly dress? Love comes back to us in courage that breaks through silence and in great laughter that shakes the foundations of this world's structures of denial and exclusion. The caller did come to church the next Sunday, and she was warmly welcomed and became part of our community. Love changes everything. And congregational life can be just such a place of courage and great laughter that welcomes the truth of our struggles and accepts us in all our humanness. So our little congregation in Seattle began to grow. New young people joined, people who had never been part of a church, and they were very excited to get involved in big, meaningful projects we were doing, helping refugees resettle, working for nuclear disarmament, repealing the anti-gay legislation in our city, and more. But the simple and ordinary tasks that made church a loving place, like greeters at the door on Sunday, freshly made coffee during the social hour, flowers at the altar, these they took for granted. The elders who had built the church were getting far advanced in their years and couldn't do all these tasks anymore, these tasks that made the church a home. So we decided we needed to find a way to teach the new young members what it takes to make, all that it takes to make a congregation flourish. So we came up with the following plan. One Sunday morning, when people arrived, they found the altar covered with brown paper lunch bags. And during the offering, in addition to giving a gift, everybody was invited to come up and get a gift, a grab bag. And then right there in the church service, we had everybody open their grab bag and find out what was inside. Inside were things that symbolized a task that needed doing at the church. A tea bag for setting up social hour, a card with flowers for taking care of the altar, a picture of two people shaking hands for ushering and greeting, and a card with a date on it. That was your assigned date for the task. Then we told people if they didn't like the task they'd gotten or the date, they could trade. So pandemonium broke out. And when the dust settled, we had the sign-up sheets filled for flowers, coffee hour, and greeting and ushering for all the rest of the year. That was fun. But the story didn't end here. Later that week, around 4 in the afternoon, there was a knock at my office door. I opened it to find a passel of grade school children holding protest signs, looking very serious. "We have a demand," they said. "Okay, come in and tell me about it." They crowded in, and then their appointed leader with crossed arms said, "Where are our grab bags?" All the adults at church on Sunday got jobs. Don't we get any jobs? Aren't we part of the church? "Wow," I said, "we goofed." "Yes, you are part of the church. Yes, you get jobs. Let's take care of that right now." And they pulled out the sheet of paper with a list of things they were offering to do. Dust the pews, fold the bulletins, weed the garden, stamp letters, and more. And so it came to pass that the elementary children came regularly one afternoon a week to the church and did their part. We had a lot to learn about stewardship of our church community. And the biggest thing we learned was that when everyone gives what they have to give, love grows, people grow, goodness gets handed on from generation to generation. And a turning point for our whole congregation came the year that Steve DeGroote gave the generosity testimonial. I swear the best words at church are often given in the generosity testimonial. Thank you, Katie. And I will never forget what Steve said that morning. He was only in his 20s, a new member of the church, but he gave 10% of his income to the congregation. And this is how I remember what he said. "It gives me joy to tithe to this church. And it has been a journey. I first learned to tithe as a child. My church taught me that tithing was important, and I was raised to be obedient to my church's teaching. So I tithed out of obedience. But then I matured, and my reason for tithing changed. I saw that the people I most loved and admired, people in my church who were joyful and compassionate, engaged, including my parents, tithed. I wanted to be like them. So I tithed to follow the example of people I loved. But then I matured further, and my reason for tithing changed again. Here in this congregation, I began to see all the things our church does that make more love happen in the world. And I realized I could be part of making these changes happen, this mission of love and justice making. So I tithed to support the values that I want to see grow and flourish in the world, and that make everything that we do together possible. But now, today, I have matured further, and my reason for tithing has changed again. Now I tithe because if I did not tithe, I would be lying about who I am. For I have come to know that I am a person of sacred worth. I am a beloved child of God. I have been given an abundance of gifts. I have things I can give to others and to the world. I can make a difference. This is who I am. I tithe now because this is how I tell the truth about who I am. Dear friends, this morning, I encourage you to cherish this congregation as a place where you come together to welcome one another's tears and laughter, to think deeply about the things that matter most, and to be renewed again and again in your ability to hear the deep music of love, and be people who move in harmony with that deep music. As singers and dancers of love, composers of justice, artists of peace, each of you is of sacred worth. Each of you is loved. Each of you has been given an abundance of gifts. Each of you has much to give. The world needs you to do just one thing. Tell the truth about who you really are. May it be so. Amen.